With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. Our special guests this week are Stuart Lee and Michael Cumming, who between them have made a brilliant new documentary, King Rocker, about the life and times of Robert Lloyd, frontman of The Prefects and The Nightingales, and all-round legend in his own lifetime. I've seen the film and I absolutely love it, and I'm really glad to have Stuart and Michael here to talk about King Rocker.
In Birmingham, they used to have a King Kong statue.
What does that represent? Nothing.
Birmingham rejected the statue. When I started thinking about the Nightingales and Rob Lloyd and The Prefects, I thought maybe there's some way of using images of this to tell the story of you.
Rob was my Johnny Rotten.
I think everybody who has mainstream success wishes they were a cult hero, and every cult hero wishes they had mainstream success.
Who am I right?
It's a sort of charmed life, isn't it? It's not fixed in a time. It's still free, and you were free.
I'm totally free.
Gonna carry on whatever they say.
You're in mashed up condition. That Kong's in better shape than you now.
Michael and Stuart, welcome to the Kermode on Film podcast. I'm delighted to have you on, not least because we're talking about a film about a subject which is kind of oddly close to my heart. Let's begin. Michael, tell us about the subject of King Rocker.
Well, the subject is a man called Robert Lloyd and the various sort of adventures he's had musically and otherwise. He was the lead singer of, I suppose, what some people might consider to be Birmingham's first punk band, The Prefects, and then with The Nightingales. I suppose it's a journey that Stuart takes with him, sort of meandering through his life. And as a sort of subplot, we have a massive statue of King Kong.
Okay, so Stuart, when did your connection with this story begin? I mean, how did you start becoming somebody who was interested in Rob Lloyd and The Prefects and everything?
Well, I'm a little bit about a couple of years younger than Michael, which makes a huge difference when you're a teenager, obviously, because what you engage with is completely, you know, massively different. And I know the Nightingales. I didn't know The Prefects. I knew The Nightingales from listening to John Peel all the time. And like The Fall, they were one of those groups that he played so much that you, in the end, you were ground down by it. You had to like them. But I thought they were great. And I was really glad when they got back together and started playing again, because I never saw that actual group the first time around. And of course, they've been reformed longer now than they were ever formed in the first place, as is often the case. And they asked me to open for them in 2004 when they were first back, which I did. And then I got to know Rob. And about 10 years ago, he asked me if he thought there should be a documentary about the Nightingales, and he pitched it as being it should be like the Anvil documentary about this unlucky, ridiculous band. And I really like the idea of there being a documentary about the Nightingales, but I don't think they're a joke group. I think it's funny, the things that have happened to them, and Rob is a funny bloke, and their lack of commercial success is blackly comic, but they're not inherently absurd. You know, I don't want to make a film taking the piss out of them, if you know what I mean.
Well, I mean, it's worth saying that Anvil, the story of Anvil, is all. I mean, Anvil were a serious band. The fact that film ended up being like a kind of real life Spinal Tap is partly coincidental. I mean, right down to the fact that one of them's actually called Rob Reiner, which you couldn't make up, but it's actually true. But what there is at the centre of Anvil, the story of Anvil, is a huge affection for the subject. It's not laughing at them, it's laughing with them. And as you say, there is an awful lot of comedy in what Rob Lloyd's entire attitude to the world was, as we discover from the documentary. He is somebody who is the first person to mock himself.
Yeah, well, even to the point where, having agreed to want to be in a documentary and asking us to try and make one about him, he then doesn't really want to cooperate with it or answer questions, and you had to kind of ambush him and take him to strange places to try and inspire him. But it took a lot. It took a few years to find people that would want to do it. And of course, the lucky thing was that I've known Michael going on 15 years. But it was just a sheer coincidence. About 3 years ago, it came up that he not only liked the group, but had actually proposed a documentary about Rob Lloyd to the BBC 30 years ago for a strand on an arts programme. And then I realised that if we got together, we might be able to do it between us as a kind of a labour of love, really.
So, Michael, what is it about Rob Lloyd that inspires that kind of devotion? Why was it that you wanted to make a documentary 30 years ago? Why did you want to do it now?
Well, the 30 years ago one was, as far as I remember, it was just when I'm trying to remember the name of that arts programme on BBC Two had just started. I think it was The Late Show, yeah. And I just left film school. I was working at the BBC doing, really tedious little films for Tomorrow's World with no interest in science, and really wanted to make sort of art films. And so I proposed that to them, but it was just, and they rejected it, obviously, along with several other documentary ideas that have all now become quite big documentaries, but it was just at the time, and it was a fascinating time, I thought, when Rob had released his solo album, and there was this period where he went from being in this very sort of spiky sort of post-punk thing to making a really commercial album, and I was just sort of fascinated by that, as somebody who'd sort of been to art school and made sort of films for art galleries that nobody ever watched, starting to go into the world of trying to sell yourself and make money. I thought, oh God, Rob Lloyd's made a commercial album that could be in the charts with singles that sound like sort of pop music. And that was sort of,
and what videos and videos that make him look like a glamorous pop star.
Yeah. A handsome, glamorous. Well, yeah. Stuart's theory. Well, you can tell me your theory, your Jarvis Cocker theory, Stu.
Well, yeah, I kind of think he's the Jarvis Cocker that got away, isn't it? You know, if they'd been second at a album deal, if they hadn't dropped them, then you could sort of see him filling that niche in the Britpop era of being a sort of literate, funny, quirky pop star from an ordinary background in sort of those kind of clothes, that, you know, suits, and then maybe he'd have got the impetus from that to do more with it afterwards. I kind of suspect not, because he seems to, as soon as something's about to come together, he seems to want to change it. I think it's only in the last couple of years he's really started to think, wow, I should try and get remembered or consolidate everything we've done or whatever. And that's one of the interesting things about the film, is when you see the footage from 40 years ago that we got from Arena of him being interviewed, he doesn't have any personal ambition, really.
One of the things I love about the documentary, and I really did love it, I thought it was great. Found it very moving and very funny. And there was a couple of moments when I welled up, partly because I love that idea of somebody who's kind of almost heroically stopping themselves from ever becoming Jarvis Cocker. This is almost like a heroic refusal to allow success to actually come knocking at your door. But there's the kind of framing narrative of it is related to this statue of King Kong, which obviously is, flagged up in the title. Tell us about, at what moment did you think, actually, Rob Lloyd and the Birmingham statue of King Kong are somehow genetically linked? I mean, was that something that you'd always thought, or was that an idea that came to you whilst doing the doc?
I'd always been fascinated by that statue, and I start.
For those who don't know, tell us what it is. Describe it.
Well, in 1973, Peter Stuyvesant cigarettes went into a program with local councils where they'd pay for a piece of, you know, insight art to be put up in your city, and you had it for 6 months, and then if you liked it, you could keep it. And the one that went to Birmingham was by Nicholas Munro, and it was a big statue of King Kong. And I think on some level he'd thought about the city being the concrete jungle and putting, because it had all been redeveloped in a 70s brutalist concrete kind of way at that point. And the statue did look really good there. And I seem to remember seeing it for years and going in with my gran when she took a Place the Ball coupon to the Birmingham Evening Mail and seeing it, and it being a real treat. But actually it was only there for 6 months, because at the end of the 6 month period, but Birmingham rejected it. And they didn't want it, and it was sold to a car showroom on the Stratford Road.
That you used to drive past with your grandmother.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And I began to think I'd imagine it, because I never seemed to meet anyone that remembered it. And this was before the internet, where you could check things as well. And I met one guy, an actor, who said he remembered it, but most people didn't. You couldn't. Then about 20 years ago, I was trying to interview Rocky Erickson from the 13th floor elevators for the newspaper, and I didn't have a phone at the time, and I went and did it overnight in the newspaper offices. I'd lived in a flat in a cellar with no coverage, and I did it in the newspaper offices, and I was sitting in this office, and there was a book on the shelf saying Public Sculpture of Birmingham, the book was called. And I looked in it, and there was a half page about this statue, but it said it had been destroyed. And then smashed up and thrown away in a sold to a market in Edinburgh. And I'd always had it at the back of my mind that it would be an interesting story to try and tell. And then I don't know when I thought about connecting it with Rob. I know that around the time we were thinking about the film, the statue had been rediscovered by the Henry Moore Institute. It was still in one piece, and they'd put it on display in Leeds. And there was a lot of rethinking about the value of public art. And I know that I thought of it in terms of, here's a thing that Birmingham rejected, along with its 70s architecture, that years later people are like critically rehabilitating. And I did think about that in terms of a connection with Rob. And I had talked to Michael about it. But the weirdest thing was, and I'd actually written a long essay about that idea, I think, at one point. But the weirdest thing was, when we first time we went to see the Nightingales together in about 3 or 4 years ago at the Lexington in King's Cross, Rob started doing all these moves on stage like this, you know. And afterwards we said to him, what were you doing when you were doing all that? He said, I was thinking about that King Kong statue in Birmingham. And I thought, is he psychic? Is he trying to kind of mess with my brain? I went, what? And I was quite aggressive at the moment. What are you doing? What are you talking about? Because I knew he couldn't have known that I'd been thinking about it. But it does seem to suit him. And I noticed in whoever the guy that edited the trailer has done a fantastic job of pulling out images of Rob, where he seems to be
it looks exactly like King Kong
throughout it. And it just created some other through line to it, and it meant we got different kinds of footage, different sorts of textures of news footage, and also just about how, you know, that statue was hated. The Angel of the North was hated in Newcastle until, I think, the football team, the Newcastle team, won some big derby, and someone climbed up it overnight and hung a massive magpie shirt on it. And then after that, people sort of took ownership of it. That never happened to the Kong, and and I think the Nightingales have been sort of the same for that city. The punk scenes of Manchester and Liverpool, the Throw Up Yak and the Bunny Men and the Teardrop Explodes and the Fall and New Order, and people are very proud of them, but there's something self-effacing and modest and sort of dysmorphic about Birmingham, where it doesn't tend to recognise its own artists. And I think it did turn out to be a good parallel. Of course, we've got fascinated by that sculpture and that sculptor now. And one of the things is, we think if anyone is interested in this, is there might be something in the story of him. He made a giant Morecambe and Wise as well.
Oh, really?
Which has gone missing.
Which was, I think, was equally hated at the time as well.
Wow.
It was smashed up, wasn't it? It was smashed up by the public, actually broke it, part of it to bits.
Yeah.
But it's a brilliant analogy, and it works really well for this kind of larger than life character. Michael, in terms of then telling that story, what kind of access did you have to archive footage? Because I remember when I first heard from Stuart that the documentary had been made, I remember thinking, is there that much footage? And in fact, because watching the documentary, there's much more than I expected.
Yeah, there did turn out to be a little bit more. I mean, I was aware of the arena doc. It was a fantastic arena documentary by Anthony Wall about John Peel, and it focuses on three or four of Peel's favourite bands, of which the Nightingales are one of them. So there is some really lovely footage, two songs in performance and a couple of interviews, all shot in that fantastic old BBC 16mm lovely arena way. And I knew about that, and I couldn't remember whether I'd hallucinated it, but I was pretty sure I remembered seeing them on Razzmatazz, the kids' pop show from the 80s, playing Rockin' with Rita, which was their sort of almost hit that never quite was. But other than that, I didn't think there would be anything else. And bit by bit, things started to emerge, you know, a little bit of footage here, a little bit of footage there. I mean, there's a few other things that we just couldn't afford, because it was really a sort of no budget film in many ways. We had a little bit of crowdfunding, and Stuart and I did some benefit sort of gigs to raise money for it. But there was a sort of limit on what we could acquire. There was actually a really good pop video that they made for Rockin' with Rita, which that they shot in Blackpool, but it was just sort of beyond us to get that for some reason. But
who owns it? I mean, is it owned by a big company?
Well, I think they signed to Warner. They were at Warner's, WAA, weren't they?
It was an asset of Warner's, and it may still belong to Warner's, or have been purchased by some company that have taken all that on. And it was,
but in a way, not having that footage, you know, made it us be more inventive, and that's why the sort of, in a way, the King Kong thing was a great way of, you know, we found some fantastic footage of that, and in a way that sort of set the period scene rather than, you know, some old clip of them playing in.
Yeah. I never felt watching the doc that we were missing stuff. I never got the sense that there was, you know, that there were any holes in it. In fact, I think you're probably right that having to work around what you had makes the film more interesting than just a kind of, you know, clips and talking heads. Also in terms of the interviews, I know recently Julian Temple was on talking about making the Shane McGowan doc, which obviously was an uphill struggle because, you know, Shane McGowan isn't just never going to have a conversation about himself. And so they had to do all these kind of devices. And one of the things that happens in King Rocker is that we see it's not an interview. It's a conversation, Stuart, between you and him. And I presume that was because, you know, you don't want to do a straight interview. What you want to do is, so because the way in which he talks is much more conversational.
Yeah, he wanted to get a sense of what he was like, and he wasn't going to do an interview. And also, when we first talked about doing this, I watched a lot of rockumentaries, and I thought, and my son, he was about 10 at the time, kept sticking his head in, and I went, what have all these got in common? And he said, they're all old men being interviewed about things and then black and white footage of stuff. And I thought, right, okay, so we'll try not to make it. So there are some slightly formal interviews, the Paul Morley one and the James Brown one. The Paul Morley one, I sort of think, is almost like a parody of a rock documentary. It's like, even in this, he's in it. He has to be in it.
Well, there was one moment where I nearly considered, I mean, I like Paul and I wouldn't want to do that to him, but there was one moment where I considered just having him say the word yes in the documentary, where there's something that somebody else says and then it just comes to Paul and goes, yes. And then that would have been it. But I thought, no, we can't do that. But
again, I never thought about it at the time, because I am sort of used to being me in things, and I hadn't realised as we embarked on it that it was slightly odd having a me character in a rockumentary, but it isn't unusual for a Nick Broomfield film or an Andrew Cotting film for one of the filmmakers to be a sort of personality in it. And certainly knowing the fact that I knew Rob helped to bring out his personality more than in conversations would with a sort of more neutral interviewer, or with no one in the shot at all, because you have to sort of, he's happy to talk expansively with anecdotes and witty sayings and stuff, but he doesn't really like giving anything away of himself. And in fact, in the end, we were lucky enough to be able to get Louis, his son, to talk to him. You know, we needed the part of the story where it all goes wrong, and I was never going to get that story out of Rob, but in conversation with Louis, his son, he did sort of offer it up. And I think that bit of it's very weirdly moving, actually, where they're remembering the missing years of Rob's life, the postman years, as Tank calls it.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned Andrew Cotting, who obviously you've worked with Andrew and you know him well. I think I've only actually met him. What is it? We've kind of become internet friends. I love his movies, and I, you know, I've written about them quite a lot. And I get packages from him, as I'm sure everybody does, with a million half piece stamps on them all over, because for some reason he seems to have the largest archive of old, out of date stamps that he's not going to get rid of. And that thing about that what he does is, you know, it's filmmaking that it is intensely personal, but actually, weirdly, through that personal thing, it becomes universal. When you see a Cotting movie, you know that you can sense Andrew Cotting's spirit. I think the first time I ever met him, I interviewed him for This Filthy Earth, and he had a huge gash on the side of his head. He's got quite a big head. And I said, how did you get that? He went, oh, dry stone walling. And I thought, that's just, of course, that's why you've got a bleeding head. But that thing about it being a very personal document, I think, is perfect for the subject matter, because you wouldn't want to see something about this, about Rob Lloyd, that didn't feel deeply personal.
Yeah, and we sort of felt our way with that as well. We weren't sure exactly at first how it was going to turn out. We didn't have things like researchers, you know, things like you're supposed to have when you make a documentary. So actually, the first time we spoke to Rob, which was when Stuart and Rob sit down and have an Indian meal in Abdul's in Birmingham.
And you disturb other customers.
And we disturb other customers.
Through, you ask them if it's all right, you carry on, which is a lovely
And
moment.
Obviously that's going to be in. But that was, we weren't even sure at first whether that would even be in the film, any of that. That was almost like a research chat that we put some cameras on, and we sort of thought, well, let's see what happens, see what we get out of him, and then we can maybe talk to him again about some of the things, which we tried to a little bit. But because of it was that first time that he'd spoken to Stu like that, it we ended up using a lot of that. And there was a few moments like that where we didn't really, or I didn't really expect that we'd end up using certain things. And then they ended up being, you know, a through line throughout the whole thing. So,
I mean, a thing that was like a Cotting film was, because there was only me and Michael, really, when something did just happen, or it occurred to Rob, or he remembered something, we were able, as this mobile unit, to deviate and go and try and find out about it and pick it up. It wasn't locked into a schedule. And a lot of things only came up in the closing moments. So this whole story about Danny Fields and the Ramones having been friends with him when he was sort of 17, just, we found out about, we were already nearly, you know, laying it off, basically, and it came up. Then other things, Simon Munnery, the comedian, always says, all works are work in progress. They're never finished, they're just abandoned. And since we finished it, things have come up. The other day, Rob sent me an email saying, oh, look at this. And it was a video him and Stephen Wells had shot for Skunk and Anansie, the sort of early 90s kind of metal band. And in it, Stephen and Rob, who are both in the film, characters in the film, and Ted Chippington, who's in the film, were extras. In a black and white sequence in which they escorted Jesus through a crowd of reporters. And I said, so you're telling me you've got a film of you, Ted and Stephen, dressed as reporters, escorting Jesus through a crowd of reporters, and you've just remembered this? Because, of course, it's exactly the sort of thing you could have dropped in. And then right towards the end, we found out that he and Tank, the guitarist, had been on the Scottish folk fiddler Ali Bain's folk programme, which was recorded on a barge in the Clyde in 1990, and had done something so mad that the footage was never shown. I don't know what it was, and that footage, I couldn't find it. I'm not, I wrote to people at STV and I found the director of it, but no one knew what had happened to it. So that's out there somewhere. And you kind of, you do think about the things that you've missed. But on the other hand, the limitation meant that we didn't end up making one of these sort of 12-hour documentaries about the Eagles. And it's got a narrative through line to it.
Yeah, it's got an arc.
People who don't know anything about this kind of music or these people. It's a story about a person.
If it's got anything, it's got an arc.
But you know, I know it always sounds like contrivance, but it has got an arc to it. I mean, I think that scene at the end, and there's a lovely moment when you're there with the statue and you deliberately walk out of shot to let Rob, you know, have whatever that moment is. I was in tears. I mean, I just thought that was really moving. There's also the peculiar thing about the documentary is this: although Robert Lloyd may not be a household name, people who love Prefects and Nightingales absolutely are, you know, completely devoted. Also, I think people will find, oh, that's the connection. Because Stuart, you and I have emailed each other a little bit since I watched the doc. And I said, of course, I've got a weird personal connection to this, which is that in the mid-80s or the 80s, one of the bands, my favourite bands, was Toxic Shock. And Toxic Shock were these two women who were on Vindaloo Records, which, of course, was Rob's record label. And they made two brilliant EPs, which I absolutely loved. And then after they stopped playing together, I very briefly came down to Birmingham and played guitar very badly.
I didn't know that at all.
No, but of course, but why would you? But the weird thing is that you said, oh, yeah. And then somebody else I spoke to said, oh, there was this connection through this. And somebody else I spoke to said this. And actually, for somebody who sort of seems to have gone under the radar for some popular culture, the tendrils of what Rob Lloyd has done have gone everywhere. I mean, I will go to my grave being thankful to Vindaloo Records for making those two Toxic Shock EPs, which I think are among the two finest records I have ever owned.
Well, a lot of people were connected to him that we couldn't get to speak to as well. We wanted to talk to Pete Shelley actually as well, because from the Buzzcocks, because there was a period, according to some sources, where Rob was going to replace Howard Devoto in the Buzzcocks, but then Pete Shelley died before we could talk to him. And you know, Julie Christie, we wanted to talk to, because apparently he tortured every day when he delivered her mail. I mean, there were all kinds of strange overlaps.
But talking about the Vindaloo connection, I mean, Stuart himself has said, well, he says it in the film, you know, he was inspired to start doing stand-up because of Ted Chippington on the Vindaloo label one night at a gig, you know.
Yeah, I absolutely wouldn't be doing it without that.
I mean, that amazing thing about, because the period that, you know, that I was connected to this, I remember what happened was Fuzzbox's first EP had come out on Vindaloo, and there was some suggestion that this was about to be something really big, and then the next thing you knew, they were on Top of the Pops doing International Rescue. And this all appeared to happen in a very sort of brief period of time. But there was this period when there was them, Ted Chippington, Toxics, you know, Nightingale. There was this kind of group of people who were just on the brink of stuff, and I was just before that. And then the next thing I remember was suddenly they were all on Top of the Pops. And Ted Chippington, who I remember when somebody described Ted Chippington's act, I saw him play live, it must have been in Manchester. I said, "What, you know, what does he do?" And they said, "Well, he doesn't really do anything. That's the point." And I said, "What is it like?" He said, "It's impossible to describe. It's like..." And then they said something like situationist comedy or something. Because I said, "Well, does he tell jokes? Does he sing songs? What does he do?" And they said, "You have to see it. He just, you know, it was indescribable what he did or didn't do, wasn't it?"
We were supposed to interview Ted for the film, and he just never turned up. To the interview in Totnes, which is perfect, really. Although I'm sometimes paranoidly think that he must sort of hate me, because, you know, when Rob wanted to put out a box set, but Rob put out a 4-CD box set of Ted, which is hilarious. There's not really any content at all. It's the whole point of it. He's massively over-documented. But I think he might hate me on some level, because I took a little germ of what Ted does, which is to sort of have an act that has a critical relationship with stand-up on some level.
Yeah.
Extrapolated it out into a whole different thing. But if I'd never seen him, I would never have been the comedian I am, and I wouldn't have had the life that I'd had. But
it was his act was remarkable, wasn't it? Because it is really hard to explain what it was that he did.
Well, in the we couldn't get him to do the interview, but we had found a clip that of Stewart talking to him that he did on the Culture Show. And he says something, you know, you say, you know, what were you, did you see yourself as a comedian? He says, no, I was just some bloke doing something for no particular reason. That sort of sums it up.
That's it.
I love the thought of, I mean, I don't know what will happen to this film, but I like the thought of that being seen in other countries or in America or whatever. what was that? And what culture was able to support it? And I think in some ways, you know, it's a love letter to a missing time, weird window, where there was a degree of freedom for people, and you could live in a squat or go on enterprise allowance or the dole and make your art. And then things started to get crunched down a bit in the 90s, and now this seems an incredible time. There wasn't the internet, and people couldn't post stuff up on YouTube and get spotted like that, but there seemed to be an amazing freedom that allowed people to do all sorts of things. And so in a way, it's an elegy for that. But what you said about it having an arc to it, I mean, there was an obviously you're trying to organize a person's life into a story. And one of the nice things about the film, which again isn't down to us, was that Rob was very resistant to that. And he could sort of tell when we were trying to get him to say certain types of things, like when he's outside the Chinese restaurant and I kind of want him to say this was quite a bad time. He sort of gets annoyed about that. And then he wouldn't, when he's at the Stone Circle, I'm trying to talk to him about the idea of people being remembered. He resists it.
He says it's the most rubbish Stone Circle he's ever seen in his life.
Yeah. And then at the very end, when I'm trying to get him to say something that is a capstone to the film, he's aware that that's happening. So it has a sarcastic relationship with the idea of structure, but nevertheless it does. When it was finally laid off, one of the films I watched afterwards that I'd never seen before, when I'm glad I hadn't seen it before, was Garnet's Gold by Ed Morris, a documentary about a guy who is a carer for his mother and decides to go to a lake in Scotland to find some treasure. And I realised that had the same structure of a person has a bit of success, things go a bit wrong, they have to come back and reach some sort of equilibrium. And of course, actually, it's a Joseph Campbell structure.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the hero's journey that you get in The Mandalorian. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's kind of...
I know, and what's beautiful about it is, and I know, you know, I know that when I say things like, I know how resistant you would be to that sort of thing, but the thing is, the reason that those archetypal structures exist is because they're archetypal structures, and you can fight them, and you can wrestle with them, and you can disavow them, but there's a reason that they keep coming back.
Yeah, because, well, I mean, having organised the material into the shape of an archetypal structure without doing it self-consciously, and then going, oh, this works, and then realising it works because it's King Arthur.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, the King Arthur thing is exactly, you know, because the sense of the Holy Fool and the sense of the loss and the redemption and everything, and also the sense of magic, because this is another thing that I think the documentary captures. I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass, which incidentally is a phrase I've never really understood. I've never really understood how would you praise somebody by never done it, I don't know, but I think that it does have a sense of magic to it, because even when you're watching it, even if you don't know anything about the Robert Lloyd story, the Nightingale story, there is a sense of coincidence, of things happening almost kind of, you know, alchemically, that if you wrote them down as a fiction, someone will go, that's overdoing it. You know, that there isn't any way that that would happen. I mean, the very fact that there was this sudden moment of, you know, Fuzzbox on Top of the Pops and Ted Chippington on Razzmatazz. I mean, I was in a band in the 80s. We did every kids show going. I mean, there's probably more footage of me playing on Whack-A-Day and Wide Awake than there is anywhere else. I mean, God bless those things. But if you made it up, no one would believe you. And I do think that there is a magical thing to it. There is a sense that the documentary captures, and Michael, I think you've done a brilliant job with this, of giving you the sense that you've got a lightning rod at the middle of it. And somehow, for all his reticence, he is the person who's attracting all these things. And it, you know, and the documentary, I think, gives it a sense of magic.
Well, even the again, by coincidence, the story, you know, the King Kong statue story is sort of, in a way, follows the story of actual King Kong, the movie, you know, his journey as well is kind of interesting too. But, you know, these are sort of happy accidents in some ways. But
I just watched your thing about, Mark, about British comedy films, and you talk a lot about the idea of the little man being a thing that we relate to.
Yeah.
And the different permutations of that character. And Rob fits that. He's attractive for that reason.
Absolutely.
He's a kind of little man to Norman Wisdom, but he's a fighter who wanted to be free and not have to fit in. And he does this from a standing start with no real advantages, you know. And so I think people can relate to that idea of the person trying to have an adventure and follow their dreams when everything's really stacked against them.
But also, you can't be Rob Lloyd and do that and keep that sort of thing on the road for all those years without being sort of fiercely committed to it and having a strong, you know, there's a brilliant bit where you're in his office, Stu, and, you know, you're sort of quite surprised how organized he is because he's got all his things alphabetically labeled and his lyrics and his, you know, and, you know, he sort of jokingly says, oh, you thought I was a bit of a shambles, didn't you? But, you know, and that's the thing, you've got to, he is sort of on it. He comes over sometimes as being a sort of slightly shambling character. And I suppose in the same way as Mark Smith would have done, but you can't keep The Fall or The Nightingales or, you know, that sort of thing on the road and going for all that time without having that incredible sort of self-belief. And because nobody's going to help you, you know, most of what The Nightingales have done up until recently, he's had to make happen, you know.
Yeah. I mean, the difference with
they don't have management or, you know, they don't have management or things like that, really. They sort of do it themselves.
The difference with Mark Smith is it seems that people that work with Rob still have very good memories of him, whereas of the 160 people that were in The Fall, you know,
yeah,
you can probably find four who say, you know, yeah, it was really good fun. I really, really enjoyed it. I mean, I remember talking to Mark Riley when we were doing the Radcliffe and, you know, Riley show that involved with, you know, asking Mark what it was like being in The Fall. He said, well, it was brilliant because they were The Fall, but it was horrible. You know, it was just getting told
that,
off.
That was a nice thing about this, and it's good to revisit those memories. Is not normally when you work, you know, quite closely with people, there are little frictions and things, but this was great, actually. And I like everyone that was involved in it more, having worked for 2 years with them on it, than I did before. And I hope it's a film that people see now, because it's got a lot of things. It's got a lot of shots of the outside world, which you don't see much of. You've got a lot of shots of people in rooms packed together, having a good time, drinking or watching music or whatever, which we don't do at the moment. And also, I hope it reminds people, there's a lot of hot air being expanded at the moment about, you know, live comedy and live music and what will happen to it and how will it survive. And I tend to think people that don't know much about it imagine it all happening in enormous arenas funded by massive companies. But of course, the majority of it is places like the venues that we see in this film, and little bands like the Nightingales, half their work would have been in Europe, getting playing to their 50-seater rooms in Brussels or Berlin as well. And, you know, and it's going to really, everything's going to really struggle to get going again. So, you know, as well as being about Rob and the 80s, it's also, I think it's about all that level of live art and how it works. And, I mean, touring with them made me realise, when we were making the film, I opened for them for about 6 months on and off. And, you know, the van is not roadworthy, really. It was on its last legs, kept breaking down. Everything's a struggle from place to place. They don't have any of the financial leeway that someone like me has, where there are guarantees from venues or whatever. It's really, really hard work. And they do a tiny venue in Kent every year, a little theatre in Margate that holds about 30 people, because they say there's a really nice fish and chip shop there. I mean, it's really sort of boiled down to the basics.
Well, look, you say that you hope people
see him again. You know, can't wait to see him again.
You say that you hope people will see the film. Where can people? Because I know that one of the things, obviously, you were going to be out on tour with the film. You were going to be doing, you know, Q&As and everything, and what with one thing and another, that's not happening. So, where are people going to be able to see King Rocker?
Well, it premieres on Sky Arts, the new Freeview Arts channel, and that will be on February the 6th at 9 p.m. But we do still hope, and we really, really hope, that there'll be some cinemas left and that we can go and show this in cinemas. At the moment, we're talking about possibly September, but at some point, we definitely will go out and show it, because it's just so nice to see it in a room full of people and get their reactions. And
when me and Michael were doing the benefits to raise the money for it, I'd do an hour of stand-up work in progress and he'd show his film that he made about Brass Eye and talk about it. They were really great, fun nights. And we did about three of them at Earth, the big old cinema in Dalston in Hackney, which is about 600-700 people, sold out. And when we showed a half-hour taster of what we'd got of King Rocker at the end of the night, people were really laughing at where the jokes were. Really properly 600-700 people in cinema laughing at things like the edit where Rob saying that Frank Skinner wasn't in The Prefix, and then Frank Skinner starts talking about how he was in The Prefix. And we've both worked in comedy all our lives, so we really have a sense on just a practical level of how to make a film like that funny. And it was brilliant seeing it. It reminded me of being a kid and going to see Airplane in a full cinema in Birmingham and everyone really laughing at it. And it would be great to get it out there and to be there with it and to see it going down well in a room and to do Q&As and stuff and make an event of it, to try and make the screening of it an event. And hopefully that's something we can do in cinemas when it's over. I think Fire Records, who helped us with it, can organise a distribution of it as a piece of physical media at some point, which would be great, because there's loads of extras which, if you're a fan of the group, you'll really like. So that's where we are. But the Sky Arts thing's been a real lifeline, because it was just like so many things at the moment, it was disappearing into limbo. So it was great.
Well, I'd very much like to invite both of you, assuming that by the time we get to September, things are open again. And I know it's a big assumption, but if we are, to come on the live MK3D show at the BFI South Bank. We can maybe even screen the film afterwards, because it would be lovely, as you say, to have this conversation in front of an audience and to see the film in front of an audience. I've seen it now at home.
That's
only.
Very, very kind of you. And, I emailed you out of the blue via The Observer, and I had no idea that you had any knowledge of that time and those people. And thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, just to get some response. I mean, nobody's really seen the film yet, apart from just a few people like yourselves. And, to get your response. And also, I got a lovely email from Anthony Wall, who directed the original Arena. Yeah. I was slightly nervous because I thought, I've hacked his footage around. And I actually love, some of his films are some of my favourite documentaries. And he wrote a really nice email back. We got a great email from Andrew Salt, who directed the John Lennon Imagine movie, which was the first sort of cinema documentary I ever remember seeing. And those sort of, just having those people sort of spur you along, because Stuart and I aren't documentary makers. We've never done this before. This is a bit of a first for us. So it's been, great to have that response.
Well, I genuinely think it's lovely. And I wouldn't have said this if I didn't think it. I mean, it's always terrifying when you get an email from somebody saying, I've made a film, would you watch it? Because because what if, and it's always a delight if that it's something lovely. And I think it's really touching and really funny. And I love the way that can, I mean, this is all stuff that I've told you before, but I think that, the weird thing about the story of Rob Lloyd is that people will realize that they're connected to it in ways that they hadn't expected. And that thing about you saying, well, I didn't know you had any connection with it. Well, I think the number of people in the sphere that are peripherally connected to it is extraordinary. And actually, that's one of the things I like about the doc, which I think probably benefits from the fact that you couldn't get all the footage that you wanted, is it feels like there's more of the story going on outside. What it makes you want to do is to go back and listen to those records and go back and find out more. And actually, I think that's the highest ideal of a doc, is something that makes you want to find out more. So that's all the smoke I'm going to blow up your ass, whatever the hell
thank you
that
for
actually means.
Thank you for blowing it.
So you'll come on the live show, presuming that we're all back in, in human contact by August or September. I'll expect you both on the show. Thanks ever so much. In the meantime, as you said, people can see the documentary on Sky Arts from, do you say the 6th?
6th September, 9 o'clock.
Fine, 6th at 9 o'clock. Thanks, Michael. Thank you, Stuart, for coming on the show. It's been great, and I look forward to seeing you in the flesh.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Good night.
Well, there we are. My thanks to Stuart Lee and Michael Cumming for joining us on Kermit on Film to talk about King Rocker. Thanks ever so much for listening to this episode. I hope you've enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed recording it. Now, as ever, if you've enjoyed the podcast, tell your friends. Remember to subscribe. Visit our Patreon page. There's loads of stuff going on over there, some kind of exclusive content. In the meantime, thanks again for listening. Stay safe. See you next week. Keep watching the skies.
This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.